Namo tassa bhagavato arahato samma sambuddhassa. Namo tassa bhagavato arahato samma sambuddhassa. Namo tassa bhagavato arahato samma sambuddhassa. Buddhang Dhammang Sanghang Namassami. We're approaching the full moon of July. Tomorrow will be Asala Puja, the month of Asala. And the day after that is the beginning of the rains retreat, as probably most people know. So this is the 3 month period, full moon of July to full moon of October, where the same group of people to be resident in the monastery for throughout that period of time, hopefully, the resident monastic community and the resident lay people will be staying here through this 3 month period. Also, Asala Puja is one of the main festival days of the year, not just because it's the beginning of that retreat season, which is the monsoon in Asia, but here is the summer retreat time. Very different in tone, in texture, and in terms of it not being the rainy time of the year, but time and sunshine and people having their holidays and building season and so forth. But also it's the time that the Buddha gave the first discourse to the five disciples, the five former companions. So 2 months after the enlightenment, and the Buddha had walked to Isipatana, to the deer park outside of Varanasi. And I was also reflecting today that the deer here are getting so friendly. This has become its own Migadaya, and sort of a Bayagiri deer park. Just as we were chanting, there was a few wandered past the window. Very tame and unafraid of humans on this side of the valley. So the Buddha made his way to Isipatana, which literally means the landing spot of the rishis. The Isi of Isipatana is the same as the Sanskrit word rishi or sages or yogis from the mountains. And apparently, the reason why it was called the Isipatana, the seer's landing place, was because when they used to fly out of the Himalayas using their psychic powers, and Isipatana was the place that they used to land before they went into Benares. That's apparently how it got its name. Anyway, the five disciples, the five former companions of the Buddha, were gathered there. And he then, having met with them and told them that he had realized full and complete enlightenment. First they were skeptical and thought that he'd given up on the ascetic path and had succumbed to indulgence, eating ordinary food. Rice porridge was considered outrageous indulgence. And so they thought he'd given up the true ascetic path and had caved in. But he reassured them that he had indeed awakened to the Dhamma, had realized the Dhamma, and that after they doubted him and expressed their skepticism, he said to them, "Well, have I ever spoken to you in this way before? Have I ever made this kind of declaration to you before?" And they said, "Well, no, you haven't." He said, "Well, listen to me, because you know, the deathless has been attained, the Dhamma has been realized, you know, listen to me, and in no long time then you too will realize that same truth, awaken to that same truth. So it's a very powerful occasion, that this the full moon of July represents this, the first transmitting of the Dhamma. It was 2 months after the enlightenment on the full moon of May. And so this is, tomorrow is also known as Dhammacakka Day, or the recollection of the turning of the wheel. That first teaching of the Buddha, the first discourse, which we often recite here, is called the discourse on the setting in motion of the wheel of Dhamma, the Dhammacakkappavattana Sutta. And in that discourse, much of the attention, you know, when we recite it and reflect on it, or the people describe the teachings that are contained within there, then the focus naturally goes on to the Four Noble Truths, and these fundamental principles, like the source code of the Buddha Dhamma, the fundamental principles of the way things are, and that this became the absolute of core, the axis of the Buddha's teaching for the next 45 years. But one of the things that's also interesting to reflect on, if you look at the teaching, it's in our chanting books, and the translation is there too, you see that before he mentions the Four Noble Truths in that discourse, he says, Dve me bhikkhave anta pabhajitena na sevitabha. There are two extremes, bhikkhus, which should not be followed by one who has gone forth, by one who is a religious seeker. And that's the extreme of indulgence in sense pleasure, and the other extreme of indulgence in self-mortification. You know, the way of indulgence and the way of mortification, or another expression that Ajahn Chah would use to explain this is the way of slackness and the way of tightness. Then he used for the first time he explained the principle of the middle way, Majjhima Patipatta Tathagatena, the middle way of the Tathagata. The middle way of the one thus gone, the one thus come. So then he says, you know, one who avoids the extremes, you know, follows the middle way of the Tathagata. And what is the middle way? And then he says the middle way, which leads to the arising of vision, the arising of wisdom, the arising of knowledge, the arising of light, the arising of Nibbana. The realization of Nibbana. You know, this is what the seeing the middle way leads to, and the middle way is then defined as the Eightfold Path. And then after that, there's that opening paragraph, then he then describes the Four Noble Truths and their different aspects and modes. But because the Four Noble Truths are such a powerful and a perfectly constructed teaching, and the middle way seems like such almost nondescript, sort of introductory passage before you get onto the real stuff of the Four Noble Truths. Sometimes we miss that, but in a way, when I've reflected on this, it seems like the just that expression of the middle way. You know, just in that, even before spelling it out as the Four Noble Truths, just in that simple expression, Majjhima Patipada, there is the whole teaching, the whole path. That is, you know, what is the middle way? You know, the middle way leads to knowledge, to vision, to wisdom, to light, to liberation. But it's so simple. It's such a bland expression. It seems so utterly unremarkable that it just slips by, and then then we only start to really pay attention as we get to the Four Noble Truths. But it's good to you know, hold back a bit and think, well, what is that, the middle way? Yeah. What is that saying to us? It's often remarked on that, you know, when we think of the middle, we assume it to be, you know, and sometimes you see interpretations of this in Buddhist literature or hear people speaking about it. You know, the middle way is the way of moderation. You're not too indulgent, not too harsh. You know, just yeah, not too hot, not too cold. You know. And looking at it as a sort of 50-50 approach, so that it's in a way it's being interpreted or presented as the way of mediocrity, you know, just not being too hard on yourself, not pushing yourself too much, just even though it's one could make a case for that, you know, and our teacher Ajahn Chah would often speak so much about the practice in terms of, you know, knowing the right amount, knowing what is podi, good enough, what's the appropriate amount. And it can look like, yeah, well, that's the middle way. It's just, you know, not too much, not too little. Right, middle way. And it, you know, it's the sort of thing that you could teach to a three-year-old. It's a very basic principle. But it's also important and useful to consider just how totally profound that principle is. If you think, in this, the Buddha's teaching, just to know the middle way, that is enough to lead to complete liberation. The middle way of the Tathagata leads to knowledge, to vision, to wisdom, to light, to nibbana. So it can't just mean, you know, you know, not too hot, not too cold. It can't just mean a sort of 50-50 approach. It can't just mean a half and half, you know, like a half decaf. Half calf, that's the middle way. You know. One of the ways that I like to characterize the middle way is that you know, if you imagine a pendulum and it, you know, swings over to the extreme of one limit. Yeah, that's the example of conduct, the extreme of indulgence, and then swings over to the other end. The other limit of its swing, of its arc, is the extreme of self-mortification, self-aversion. And then the middle way then is not just with the end of the pendulum sort of halfway down its arc, just sort of hanging straight down and say half indulgent and half ascetic. But more the middle way is the pivot from which the pendulum swings. It's the source that is at the very center. It's that the two extremes are the projection of. That's one way of characterizing it. The middle way also, it's one expression I've been reflecting along about a lot recently was when we had a gathering of the abbots of the different monasteries from around the world at Wat Pananachat in January of last year. Last year. 06, right. And we had a meeting, and Ajahn Jayasaro was facilitating it, and before we started one of our discussion sessions for various business topics, he asked people to say a few words for each of us on what were the most memorable or impactful of Ajahn Chah's teachings to us. And we all had very different memories and things that were significant and helpful to us. And one comment I particularly noticed was what Gompo Sumedho said, and that he remembered as Ajahn Chah's most impactful, significant teaching to him. And he said, Vinaya is all about clinging. Dhamma is all about letting go. And these are the way that the Buddha characterized his dispensation, his teaching, was Dhamma Vinaya. The Vinaya, the monastic discipline, Dhamma as the teachings, the sutta teachings. Or, so the Vinaya, precepts and conduct, and then Dhamma, the liberating teachings. So Vinaya is all about clinging, Dhamma is all about letting go. When you figure out how those two fit together, you'll be fine. 'Cause to the rational mind, it doesn't make sense, does it? It's just very frustrating. Right? Well, you either have to cling or you have to let go. How can they both be right? But that's exactly what the middle way is. It's this mysterious way of holding on, taking a very careful and scrupulous attitude towards the material world, towards the social world, towards our possessions, our body, our connections of the people, our possessions, other people's possessions, the material world, the things that we eat, the things that we can make our clothing with, the buildings we construct, every tiny aspect of the material world that we're connected with, our families, our fellow practitioners, fellow monastics. The Vinaya books, five volumes and a volume of sort of index, so six volumes altogether, enumerate literally about 10,000 rules and sub-rules and sub-sub-rules and sub-sub-sub-rules. Literally thousands and thousands and thousands of tiny little details that one has to pay attention to. So on the one hand, an absolutely scrupulous and thorough attention to the material world, and then on the other hand, you're letting go of everything. Sabbe sankhara anicca, all sankharas are all material things, all forms, mental and physical, are impermanent, they are unsatisfactory, not self, they're not who and what we are, you're empty of self, empty of what belongs to the self. So that on the one hand, everything matters completely. On the other hand, nothing matters at all. Both of these are true. So to the rational mind, that's deeply frustrating and annoying. Similarly, the teachings on conventional truth, ultimate truth, following the conventions of society and the conventions of Vinaya, the conventions of language, of conventions of behavior, of religious structures, etc. Following them sincerely and completely and with great commitment, but yet at the same time seeing that there's absolutely nothing there, it's all void of substance. And this is what it takes to realize the middle way, is finding that place where there's a realization of conventional truth, a realization of ultimate truth. It's almost like the way our two eyes work. The left eye sees the ultimate truth, the right eye sees the conventional truth. When both eyes are functioning well, then we have 3D vision, then we can see properly. If only one eye is working, if we fixate on the ultimate and then fixate on that nothing really matters, there, there's everything is empty and substantial, then we only have 2D vision. Or if we obsess on the realm of the formed, the conventional, the sense world, we give that an overriding substantiality. We imbue that with a solidity and permanence and value. Then again, we've still only got two-dimensional vision. But when both eyes operate, then we see in 3D. So to me, this even though the the principle of the middle way seems like, oh, well, nothing very special, or it's just, oh, well, yes, that's the middle way, very nice. And then let's get on to the Four Noble Truths, because that's where it really gets interesting, and it's intricate and thorough guidance. But just to truly contemplate the middle way, that middleness, that quality of balance itself, and to discover that mysterious middle where there is perfect composure and attunement to the situation, attunement to the present moment, where there is a respect for the ultimate reality of things, and there's respect for the conventional reality of things, and the two do not obstruct each other. This is really the whole path. This is the whole way. So just in those words, Majjhima Patipatta Tathagatena, the middle way of the Tathagata. This is the middle way of the Tathagata. This is what brings vision, brings knowledge, brings light, brings wisdom, brings the realization of Nibbana. It's just in that simple phrase. And it also, as I like to often point out, just in the word that the Buddha coined for himself, Tathagata, there's that the same mixture of principles is mirrored. Tathagata means both thus come and thus gone. Tat agata, so the word for to go, like I go for refuge to the Buddha, Buddhang saranam gacchami, gacchati, it means one goes. So tathagata, gone to suchness, tata is suchness, gone to suchness. Tat agata means come to suchness. So is the Buddha totally gone? Is he completely transcendent? Is there utter relinquishment? Or is it is the Buddha principle totally here, totally imminent, present? Tat agata, tathagata. And it seems that the Buddha deliberately chose an ambiguous term, I've often pointed out, scholars have been debating for years and years, literally millennia, over what does the Buddha really mean with this term. Did he really mean gone, or did he really mean come? Did he mean totally present or totally gone? Totally transcendent or totally immanent? And to me, it's embodying that same principle of the middle way. It's embodying the same principle that Ajahn Chah was talking about of the Vinaya is all about clinging, holding on. The Dhamma is all about letting go. The precepts and conduct, speech, is all about the here-ness, presence, attuning to the world of form, the world of sight, sound, smell, taste, and touch. And the Dhamma is about that transcendent quality, the paramatta satya, the ultimate reality. That which is to do with total relinquishment, that which is unholdable, uncontainable, outside of time, individuality, locality, identity, completely beyond all those structures. And that the Buddha principle, the Tathagata, embodies that total here-ness and total goneness. Now, similarly, one of the characteristics of the Buddha, Vijjacharana Sampanno, perfect in knowledge and conduct, also reflects that same thing, that the Buddha was not just perfected in his knowledge, in his sort of state of enlightenment, but that perfection of his liberation was also mirrored in the perfection of his conduct. He was perfectly mindful, and so his actions and his speech always perfectly accorded with the time, the place, the situation, what was needed, what was appropriate, useful for the people he was with. Or if he was alone, the state of the day or night, the state of hunger, health or sickness. Then there was the charana, the conduct, was perfectly attuned and adapted to that. So it's also interesting, just in that first paragraph of the Dhammacakka Sutta, then that the Buddha says, what is the middle way? Even there he starts to spell it out, and he describes the middle way is the Eightfold Path. Samadhiti, Samasankapo, Samavacha, Samakamanto, Samajivo, Samavayamo, Samasati, Samasamadhi, the Eightfold Path. And then when he's explaining the Four Noble Truths, and the fourth Noble Truth is the cultivation of the Eightfold Path. But right there in that first section, he's saying, okay, well, if you want to know how to establish that middleness, how to establish the heart in that attunement to the transcendent and the immanent, attune the heart to the Dhamma and the Vinaya, then this is how it's done, through samadhiti, samasankapo, right view, right intention, right speech, right action, right livelihood, right effort, right mindfulness, right concentration. It's also interesting in that the word samma, which I was just translating as right, also that's it's one of those words that English can't quite, there's no English word that quite encompasses it. Because that word samma, it's also, you can translate as perfect, or correct, or balanced. And so that maybe the word samma, I mean, is in a way right is appropriate, as in it's not just sort of right as opposed to wrong, but you know, something where that's righted is like something that's been knocked over, that you right it again, you kind of set it up straight, and you rebalance it. You know, the bottle was knocked over, and the microphone was knocked over. I just righted it, so that it's back in the upright posture. It's back. It's been set in its appropriate position. It's balanced again. So that quality of rightness or samma that's there in the Eightfold Path is, in a way, what is embodying the middleness. The Majjhima Patipada, the middleness, the balancedness, it's trying to convey that quality of a perfection, of being in accordance with reality, and of symmetry, again, perfection of symmetry and being in accord with truth. So that sometimes when we use the word right, then it has this jarring or dualistic tone to it of being opposed to a wrong. But it's helpful to take these kind of terms and explore them, you know, dig into them for ourselves. Say, well, what is samma? What is that? And that in a sense it's actually that quality of balancedness itself, like, so balanced view, balanced intention, balanced speech, balanced action, balanced livelihood, balanced effort in meditation, balanced concentration, balanced mindfulness. There's a weighing up of how things are, and finding that middle point. So to me, it's important and significant that as we practice Dhamma and immerse ourselves in the Buddha's teaching and the Buddha's way, as time goes by, that rather than getting more and more complicated, that we use the practice. If we're using the practice in a skillful way, we'll find that it actually makes things more and more simple. And that rather than feeling we have to have more and more things to explain, more and more dimensions of life, that the more that the practice evolves, the more that there's a true development of insight, the more you find that these simple, absolutely central principles can characterize, can embody, you know, the training for us. And so that we can take a simple principle like the middle way, really investigate that, explore it, get a feeling for what that is in our own heart, a realization of that, and then we can measure our moods, our feelings, our attitudes, the events of our days, the events of the world around us, and use that quality to guide us. Just the recollection of that quality, that very principle. Because it's like when we're balancing on a bicycle or on a tightrope or walking along a narrow beam or such like, that we know what balancedness is. You know, that we know when we topple off. We know when we lose that. It's like a physical signal, isn't it? It's very, very obvious. And so that we know what that is on a physical level. So just it's a way of getting a feeling for that very quality of sama, of balancedness, of middleness, in terms of the spiritual dimension of our life, knowing what is the right amount, listening to our own intuitive wisdom, attending to that, and then teaching ourselves to be and trusting ourselves to be guided by that. So it's an extraordinarily simple principle. But with that one principle in place, just like that was the preface to that in a way encompassed everything that the Buddha said after, like, you know, Venerable Sariputta said, the Four Noble Truths is like the elephant's footprint. It's, you know, all other teachings can be contained within it. But I'd even say that you can contain the Four Noble Truths within the footprint of the middle way. It's all in there. And that if that's really known or really embodied, then that's practicing the whole of the teaching, embodying the whole of the teaching, realizing the whole of the teaching. So that even though the Buddha spoke for 45 years and there's, you know, volumes of teachings and explanations and all the commentaries and Dhamma talks galore that have come in the centuries after, that everything is contained right in that very primary principle. Another way that is also characterized in the Buddha's life and is a very good example is just that of the stringed instrument. And in some of the stories of the Buddha, he's described when he was an ascetic yogi hearing a musician playing a veena, a stringed instrument. And then he had this insight in these stories of that he was too tight. Like a musical instrument, a veena, can only play harmonious and beautiful music when the strings are tuned according to the appropriate pitch. If they're too tight, then the notes will be too sharp. They'll be too high. If the strings are too slack, then the notes will be too low and jangling. And that there's an appropriate tension that these strings can be tuned to, and then when they are at that perfect tension, then music comes forth. And the music is not just the middle way, or the strings at the perfect pitch are not just half jangling and half sharp and, you know, half dull and clapping against the sounding box of the veena. It's not just a sort of an ugly mixture of the dull and the sharp, but it's beautiful music. Just as the middle way of the pendulum is the central point, the still point where the energy of the pendulum emerges from. It's not just a median, but it's a transcendent quality, the music that comes when the strings are at perfect pitch transcends the what the strings can do when they're out of pitch, It's a completely different order. It's a whole different dimension. It's a whole other range of qualities that the thinking mind and the, you know, the conceiving mind cannot reach to. So I offer these words for consideration this evening.
Annamayam dhammakathaya sadhukaram dhammase.
Sāvāvāvāvāvāvāvāvāvāvāvāvāvāvāvāvāvāvāvāvāvāvāvāvāvāvāvāvāvāvāvāvāvāvāvāvāvāvāvāvāvāvāvāvāvāvāvāvāvāvāvāvāvāvāvāvāvāvāvāvāvāvāvāvāvāvāvāvāvāvāvāvāvāvāvāvāvāvāvāvāvāvāvāvāvāvāvāvāvāvāvāvāvāvāvāvāvāvāvāvāvāvāvāvāvāvāvāvāvāvāvāvāvāvāvāvāvāvāvāvāvāvāvāvāvāvāvāvāvāvāvāvāvāvāvāvāvāvāvāvāvāvāvāvāvāvāvāvāvāvāvāvāvāvāvāvāvāvāvāvāvāvāvāvāvāvāvāvāvāvāvāvāvāvāvāvāvāvāvāvāvāvā